Thank you. As you have heard, the topic is this Ottoman railway project, planned, financed by the German Empire, German banks, and it was the project of the expansion of German economic and political influence into the East, into the what we call today Middle East. We are specially invited in this project, and I quote, and this is really the crucial point for me, we are asked, I quote, to take a view from the perspective of the railway tracks themselves, a perspective of no more than 25 centimeters above the ground. So assisting the railway to speak for itself, which means that the things should speak for themselves, and this will be the crucial point of my talk. And we are also asked to, in our reflection on this project, to go beyond the common selective historical narratives and discourses that usually address these regions, meaning the narratives of civilization, progress, development, Orientalism, etc. Within this larger task, I'm asked also to look from the one very particular perspective. This is the perspective of a famous writer, Agatha Christie, traveling, using often Orient Express to travel to the same region. Why? Her second husband, Max Mallowan, was an archaeologist, and he was traveling, and she accompanied him to the excavation sites in today's Syria and Iraq. So, and I've got even from the organizers a book about this whole story of Agatha Christie and Orient Express, and the title of the book was Agatha Christie and Archaeology. I looked at the book and then find out that original German was actually, the title was Agatha Christie and the Orient. So, you know, from the original, it was the project of the Faculty of Ancient History at the University Essen, and they organized an exhibition with the idea to turn theoretical concepts into an exhibition. But then, when the book was translated into English, the archaeology replaced the Orient. This is, for me, a very good point to start with the question, why? Why this move? I am actually a translator myself and a sort of theorist of translation. And this is very, for me, a sort of provocation. Why this move from a space, from a culturally defined space called Orient, to a time? To a knowledge on time, what archaeology is supposed to be. And so my question is, why from Orient to archaeology? Why from space to time? And I'm supposed to let things speak for themselves. And what first came to my mind, I'm translator actually of Sigmund Freud, is this famous text, the Etiology of Hysteria from 1896. This is this theory of seduction, Freud's theory of seduction. This in this text, this essay, Freud for the first time compared the logic of psychoanalysis with archaeology. And I will quote a little bit so that you get this impression. Freud asks us to, I quote, imagine an explorer who arrives in a little-known region where his interest is aroused by an expanse of ruins with remains of walls, fragments of columns, and tablets with half-effaced and unreadable inscriptions. He may content himself with inspecting what lies exposed to view, with questioning, please, this is very important, with questioning the inhabitants, perhaps semi-barbaric people, who live in the vicinity about what tradition tells them of the history and meaning of these archaeological remains, but he may act differently. He may have brought picks, shovels, and spades with him, and he may set the inhabitants to work with these implements. Together with them, he may start upon the ruins, clear away the rubbish, and beginning from the visible remains, uncover what is buried. And then this sentence: if his work is crowned with success, the discoveries are self-explanatory. Then the ruins, the things, will speak for themselves. Or, as Freud, finishing this passage, uses the famous Latin proverb, saxa locuntur, stones speak. So, stones speak. Social, in our case, railway tracks, switches, stations, even if they have been long ago abandoned. In fact, they have already been addressed a lot in this usual way of contemplating and reflecting on this region. But I suggest that we rather focus on what these narratives and discourses conceal, or better, how they silence those railway tracks, the ruins of this historical, now dysfunctional transport infrastructure. So let me, like Agatha Christie's hero, Hercule Poirot, instead of focusing on the traces, you know, footsteps, how it is in the crime stories, fingerprints, etc., use, as Poiret would say, the little gray cells to uncover the hidden truth. So, what this already mentioned slight turn in the translation from space to time, what this implies. In fact, it implies a move, as I said, from a culturally defined space to a knowledge on time. We are now talking about a travel not through a space, but a travel through time. So let us imagine Agatha Christie and his husband, Max Mallowan, the archaeologist, somewhere in the Orient, somewhere in, like, Palmyra or Ninava or Nimrud in Iraq, setting that directly resembles this Freud's metaphor of archaeological excavation and research. Everything is fine as long our little gray cells stay within the perimeter of archaeology. But the moment when they leave this space, discursive space of archaeology, and, for instance, enter another discursive field of anthropology, for instance, then we will have a problem. And exactly here, entering another discourse, the travel through time can start. So these are little gray cells in the case. They have left the discourse of archaeology and entered the discourse of anthropology. First, we'll immediately realize that not all the people from Freud's metaphor do share the same time. Freud's archaeologist, as well as Agatha Christie and her husband, don't share the same present with the people they are surrounded at the excavation site. Those, I quote Freud, semi-barbaric locals, halbe barbarische Einwohner, whom the archaeologist can question about their tradition or hire them to work at the site. Those creatures who appear in the metaphor either as we would say today, native informants, or as a cheap labor force. These are two forms of the existence of these people who surround the whole scene. It is the merit of Johannes anthropologist Johannes Fabian, who first addressed the trouble anthropology has with time in his book from 83, Time and Other, or How Anthropology Makes Its Object. He actually discovered something very simple, that the subject of anthropological discourse never shares the same time as the referent of this discourse, so that the other culture or non-European culture for European anthropology is always not only somewhere else in another space, but always already in another time. And this is the basis of the Western historicism, as well as the various developmentalist theories or theories of modernization until nowadays. At stake is, as Fabian argues, coming together of a temporal and social difference, which he describes as a denial of coevalness. His point is that the time consciousness of anthropology denies coevalness in terms that it places, as I said, the referent of its discourse in another time. Time other than the present of the producers, of the same discourse. Coevalness, on the contrary, this is the denial of coevalness, but coevalness, on the contrary, implies the recognition that the reference of anthropology inhabit the same time as the present of the producer of anthropological discourse. Moreover, does not simply mean synchronicity, Gleichzeitigkeit in German, in terms of physical time, but rather, and this is crucial, an active occupation and sharing of time. In short, coevalness is a social relation that creates a shared temporality. For Fabian, it is a matter of praxis, not any praxis, but a transformative, emancipatory praxis. Only such a social praxis can create this coevalness, and not simply a scientific discourse in relation to its referent, to its object. So what Fabian calls, on the other side, the denial of coevalness can be in fact understood as, and this is crucial, temporal dimension of the social relation of domination. This is how knowledge and science, and in this particular case, anthropology, is never innocent in the way it understands the world. So let's come back to the excavation site. We see that for Agatha Christie, the so-called Orient actually doesn't exist. At least it doesn't exist in the same time. It is a semi-barbaric world situated somewhere on a timeline between her own present and the past she and her husband were working on, excavating, as the origin of their Western historical temporality, as their own temporality, the beginning, the very beginning of this temporality. So there is no Orient outside of the Orient Express in which Agatha Christie was traveling to the sites of these archaeological excavations. Her only Orient is the Orient Express itself. It is her own garden of culture. This is the notion coined or used by Ernst Bloch in his book The Heritage of Our Time, published 1932. This is the time when Agatha Christie is traveling by Orient Express to the East. In his critique of Spengler, Oswald Spengler, you know, this thesis of the cultural crisis, etc., Bloch writes, I quote, "The very process of history is, in case of Spengler, broken up into gardens of culture, Kulturgärten, or culture souls, These are as unrelated to each other as they are without connection to man and human labor, which is the pervading matter of history. You know, this human labor is in this metaphor, this cheap labor of the other on in digging the history up. So Bloch talks of historical relativism that is caught in cultural monads, and writes, I quote, "Culture souls without," it's about culture souls without windows, with no links among each other, yet full of mirrors facing inside. This is how in an identitarian discourse with things of so-called culture, you know, your culture, my culture. This is the very precise description of the idea of multiculturalism. This is, but also very precise description of Agatha Christie's Orient Express. It is a train without windows, an enclosed cultural space out of history, with no connection to the outside worlds, but full of mirrors facing inside. These mirrors, as Johannes Fabian comments on Bloch, I quote, have the miraculous power to make real objects disappear. Ernst Bloch's The Heritage of Our Times was published, again, 1932. It was his critical analysis of the intellectual, cultural, and ideological background of at that time emerging German fascism. In one of the essays in the book, Bloch addresses the manifestations of different temporalities that coexist in one and the same present. The title of the text is Non-Synchronicism and the Obligation to its Dialectics. Ungleichzeitigkeit is this non-synchronism. It begins with the famous words, "Not all people exist in the same now." He shows how this social and cultural non-synchronism, these, as he says, things out of season, can be used by fascist politicians to push sectors, strata, classes, and entire countries toward the political right. I'm consciously quoting it today in this our political context with the rise of far right to remind you of these texts and of this topic of non-synchronism, that is such a fertile ground for fascist mobilization and propaganda. In the beginning of the 30s, Agatha Christie's Orient Express, on its way to the Middle East, passes through Europe of an emerging fascism. Italy, Orient Simplon Express, because after the end of the First World War, it changed the route, so it went through Italy and what is former Yugoslavia, Slovenia, Croatia, etc., not via Germany and Austria. So Italy at that time is a fascist state. Italy is a state totally obsessed with the past. You know, the fascists want to build their future on the tradition of the Roman Empire, Roman tradition. It's the most powerful ideological force. Mussolini calls the Mediterranean, the whole area, Mare Nostrum, which is our sea, which is a Roman. Notion but used by fascists. At the same time is here in Germany, in this year 32, Murder on the Orient Express was published 34, at the beginning of 34. But she was traveling at that time through Europe by Orient Express. So here in Germany, here in Berlin, as reported by Alfred Sohn-Rettel, probably the most important theorist of German fascism. As you probably know, he wrote this famous book, Economy and Class Structure of German Fascism. He was at the same time, at that time, working for one lobbying organization of the leading German export industry, the so-called Mitteleuropäische Wirtschaftstag, MWWT, and it was precisely 1939 where in this lobbying organization the compromise was reached between German industry and big agrarians, a compromise that brought actually Hitler to power, made German capitalist class, made them for them possible to endorse and support Adolf Hitler. This is what happens 32 here in Berlin. And this lobbying organization, its task was the expansion of German influence, economic and political influence, into the southeast. It was actually following the same ideological and political direction as was those within which 30 years ago the Ottoman railway network was also built. So you see this continuity. But Agatha Christie's Orient Express has no windows, so she doesn't see anything in the space she travels through. Rather, she looks inwards, into the mirrors of her own cultural garden, which she decorates with her crime stories. The mirrors that, I repeat, Fabian, have the miraculous power to make real objects disappear. In this concrete case, it is the whole history that at that time is taking place around the traveling Orient Express. So the Orient Express has in fact nothing to do with the Orient itself. Rather, it is a metaphor for Europe of the 30s, a metaphor for an overall non-synchronicism, which according to Bloch led the German middle class to support Hitler. 5 minutes. Okay, the train doesn't travel through time, but carries within its own time, which it doesn't share with its surroundings, which is precisely what makes it an instrument of domination. As such, Orient Express is even not able to map a space. Writing on politics of travel and metaphors of space, Jacques Rancière states that what is theoretically at stake in traveling is not discovering far countries and exotic habits, but making the slight move which shapes the mapping of there and here. However, this mapping for Rancière must have an utopian character. Utopia for him is not the distant island, the place which is nowhere. It is the power of mapping together a discursive space and a territorial space. Agatha Christie's Orient Express has no such power. It is rather a metaphor of being historically out of sync. Instead of mapping a utopian space, it rather makes a historical non-space, which is in fact a very dangerous place. It might well be that we are now, like Agatha Christie, almost a century ago, traveling in our own Orient Express. Just imagine how's their culture, their Welt, and its events, like in our own cultural garden, looking inwards into the mirrors of our discourses and artistic performances. And it might also be that we are, like Agatha Christie before, out of sync with history. That we, like German middle class in the 30s, are blinded and seduced by our own historical non-synchronicism. So the story of the Orient Express is about us. De te fabula narrat, the story talks about you, not about distant cultural spaces somewhere in the past. So there is a talk around us these days about Europe of different speeds, you have heard it, of different temporalities. So it is already officially admitted that we don't live all in same now. But moreover, not all Europeans live in the same past. While here in Germany, those who praise heroic deeds of German soldiers in both world wars, like Alexander Gauland from AfD a few days this month, are still on the fringes of the official politics for a while, you know, until the election, at least. In other parts of Europe, the past has already been radically transformed. 3 minutes more. In Croatia, where I come originally from, it looks like the other side have won the Second World War. The memory of successful anti-fascist struggle, as you know, the partisans of former Yugoslavia won themselves, liberated themselves, the country from fascism. all the memories have been totally erased. 3,000 monuments of the partisan struggle have been destroyed, even by Croatian army. So there are no those signs in the public space, and they are replaced by the symbols of once defeated local fascists. Their insignia are omnipresent in the public space. You can just imagine the president of Croatia invites for the party, inauguration party, a guy who is famous of being filmed in a Nazi uniform with a swastika. Or near the concentration camp, you have a plate with Ustasha's salute, which is fascist salute. It is like Sieg Heil in Germany. Can you imagine something like that in Weimar near Buchenwald? But it is the reality. In fact, the historical revisionism invented here some 30 years ago is the most successful German intellectual export in the last few decades. Not only it has become the very ideological background of the European Union, because, you know, 2009, the declaration passed by the European Parliament on the so-called two totalitarianism as the legacy of common legacy of the European Union. This is the ideological background of the European Union, and this is actually the logic of historical revisionism. It is official ideology of some European states, like in Croatia. As in the time of historical fascism, the non-synchronism serves similar goals, the expansion of power and domination. It is in this context that we should think of Orient Express as being still alive, not only as a cultural garden of the middle-class intellectuals and artists, but also fulfilling similar purposes, the expansion of economic and political power and domination. A few days ago, the Süddeutsche Zeitung published an article on weapons deliveries from the countries of former Yugoslavia. It's hundreds of millions of dollars, 1,000 tons of weapons and ammunition produced there and transferred via US military base in Ramstein in Germany to the Middle East, to the so-called moderate rebels in Syria, and ended actually in most of these weapons in the hands of ISIS. In fact, these are same weapons I was trained while I was serving the Yugoslav People's Army in Belgrade some 30 years ago. So I traveled a lot between Zagreb and Belgrade. And somewhere in the middle, you know, this is the route of the Simplon Express. And actually murder on the Orient Express happens in Vinkovci, in the middle on this route. So this is where the story actually happened. So the story of the murder on the Orient Express has not ended. The murders are still going on, and we are all complicit in that crime. Like the Orient Express was itself serving similar purpose similar purposes. So instead, like in the archaeological discourse, let stones speak themselves, saxa locuntur. I will let here the weapons talk, speak for themselves. Arma locuntur, the weapons I was once trained with. And today, they help the murder in the Orient go on. So, Arma Lokuntur, please, the slideshow. Thank you. Okay, thank you.